Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the States and Communities Sharing Their Experiences, Strength and Hope for Recovery for Children and Families webinar. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will be given at that time. If for any reason you should require assistance during your call, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. I would now like to turn this conference over to your host today, Ms. Mary O'Brien. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you. This is Mary O'Brien, and on behalf of the National Child Welfare Resource Center for Organizational Improvement, I want to welcome everyone to today's call on States and Communities Sharing Their Experience, Strength and Hope for Recovery for Children and Families. This is the second part of a two-part webinar series, Being Successful, Meaningful Collaboration to Improve Outcomes for Families with Substance Use Disorders. Our resource center coordinates technical assistance for state, county, and tribal child welfare agencies from a group of national resource centers that are part of the Children's Bureau Training and Technical Assistance Network. In that role, we work to promote awareness of all of the federally funded resources available to help child welfare agencies meet their goals. One critical resource is the National Center on Substance Abuse and Child Welfare. And we're really pleased that the National Center has joined with us today to co-sponsor this call and to present today's session. So in a minute, I will turn the session over to Nancy Young, who's director of the National Center on Substance Abuse and Child Welfare, who will be speaking with us and helping to moderate today's call. We also have with us as speakers today representatives from child welfare and courts and substance abuse treatment agencies from three different states. We have from New York, Larry Pasty, who's director of the Bureau of Planning and Intervention Design in the New York State Office of Children and Family Services. Then we'll hear from Minnesota. We have Dan Griffin, who's a court operations analyst for chemical health with the Minnesota Judicial Branch State Court Administrator's Office. Then from Maine, we have Robert Long, who's the Administrator for Access and Outpatient Services with Kennebec Behavioral Health, and Michael Brennan, who's a policy associate with the Institute for Child and Family Policy. Before we begin, I just want to go over a few logistics. There are two parts to today's webinar, the audio line that you are all listening on. Hopefully, those of you listening have found your confirmation emails from Michelle Freeman. You need to click on a link in that email to get connected to a screen where you can watch the PowerPoint presentation live as we go through it today. If you're listening and you have not found that link, or if you wish to print the slides, you can go to the Resource Center for Organizational Improvement's website, which is www.nrcoi, as in National Resource Center for Organizational Improvement, nrcoi.org. Look under teleconferences and the date of today's session, May 6th. At that website, you'll also find handouts for today's call. There's an agenda with contact information for all of the speakers and background material for each of the three sites we'll be hearing from today, from New York, Minnesota, and Maine. That website, again, is www.nrcoi.org. I wanted to let you all know that we've had a tremendous interest in today's call, and we expect to have over 80 lines participating. We have representatives from over 30 different states, from child welfare agencies, substance abuse agencies, and lots of providers, as well as some of our federal regional office folks from the Administration on Children and Families and other national organizations. So because of that large number of participants, we're keeping the lines closed, and you'll hear we will, as the operator said, we'll open them for questions a few times during this session. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Nancy Young to begin.
Great. Thank you very much, Mary, and welcome to all of you who are participating with us today, and especially to our three speakers. We appreciate very much, our four speakers from three states. We appreciate very much you all taking the time to share your experience with us. Why don't we advance to the next slide and give some instructions about asking some questions. There's a couple ways in which you can ask questions. One, we mentioned already that we will have a session at the end of the webinar for you to ask questions of the speakers. But also, as you see on the screen, on the right-hand side of your computer screen, you can click where it says questions and answers. type in a question, and we will be keeping track of those as you put them in during the session, and we'll answer those at the end of the speakers also. To move forward then on today's topics, we've already mentioned that we have some state experience from New York, Minnesota, and Maine. To get started, we'll be looking at some background information about the National Center on Substance Abuse and Child Welfare, and in particular, highlight some of the TA or technical assistance that's available that we've worked with states over about a year and a half period of time to work with them on their strategic planning on substance abuse, child welfare in the courts. You heard in great detail at our last webinar, if you were able to participate, about the various kinds of technical assistance that the National Center has put together. And I want to do a quick poll, if we could, to find out if you participated in that last webinar. If you just click on your screen, and we will get the answers momentarily to find out if those of you that are participating today were also on the webinar on April 24th. Kathleen, you can give me a signal when we're ready to move on. All right, there we go. So we have a little more than half that were not on the April 24th webinar. So we would encourage you to follow up and spend some time on our website. And we'll give you that website address a couple different times, but it is on the front page. Oh, it isn't, but we'll make sure that that you do get that. Mary gave you the website for the National Resource Center on Organizational Improvement, and you can also on the last slide, I believe, is the listing of the National Center's website so that you can visit that and look at the various products that have been developed by the National Center on this topic. Let's move on then to talk about some of that technical assistance just more broadly. The National Center is funded by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration, as well as the Office on Administration, the Administration for Children, Youth, and Families, the Children's Bureau's Office on Child Abuse and Neglect. If we can move forward, you'll see that the I'm a little out of sync with our slides. I apologize. The objective of our technical assistance is to share knowledge across the three systems of substance abuse, child welfare, and the dependency court. To promote understanding of the cross-systems issues and to advance that collaborative practice that needs to go on across these systems when we're working with families at the nexus of substance abuse, child welfare, and involvement in court. And the three speakers that we have today represent those three systems and will share their perspective of working collaborative at the state level in their individual states. We also have a big focus, if you will, on the communication that needs to happen across systems at the state level that you'll hear about today, but also at the practice level when workers are interacting on a daily basis with their colleagues from the various service sectors and making sure that they are enhancing their own practice and making sure that families are at the center of that collaborative practice in their communication. So a lot of the technical assistance products that we have developed, and you'll see those on the next page, the types of TA products that we've developed have been focused on collaborative practice and communication. And much of our work is then generated by states or communities, local offices who call and ask for a variety of types of assistance. We've responded to that with practice tools and policy tools on how to measure the strength of the connections across systems, how to set priorities about which area of the collaborative practice a particular jurisdiction needs to work on. I mentioned that communication and how important that is at the practice level as well as at the policy level. There are some models as well as tools to help states and communities and practitioners work on their communication to make it much more efficient and more effective. We often say kind of reducing the noise and increasing the communication. We also have expert consult and research that's available to really anyone that calls up or sends us an email and says you need some information on a particular topic. We're more than happy to let you know if we have that available already or to put you in touch with an expert in that particular area. We have developed a series of white papers and monographs and fact sheets and different kinds of materials that are specific to particular issues that have been raised by those that have requested technical assistance in the past, and we've tried to respond to those with this series of written materials that answer some of the questions that we get most frequently. We're also very excited about the training and resources that are available on our website. In particular, there are online courses that have been approved by the National Association of Social Workers, as well as by the National Association of Alcohol and Drug Professionals that provide continuing education units free of charge. It's about 4 CEUs, and it takes about 4 hours to complete each of the courses. So again, I would encourage you to visit our website and look at those training resources. The courses have been taken by over 7,000 people from across the country now that look at those materials and complete those courses. The first one geared to substance abuse professionals, and it teaches them about child welfare in the courts. The second one geared to child welfare workers, and it teaches them about addiction treatment and recovery. And we're in the final programming phases, and hopefully we'll be releasing our third online course very quickly, and that is geared to courts and attorneys and administrative officers that work in the courts. And judicial officers to ensure that they have the information that they need readily available to work more effectively on this issue. And then finally, the longer-term strategic planning and development of protocols that I mentioned that each of the states that will be talking today will be telling us about their experience in. Now, if we can look at the next slide, you see that the way that we organize our technical assistance is in various levels. And from those short answers, someone calls up, needs some particular facts or short answers about some things, and then into the more in-depth levels with asking for expert consult or development of some issue-specific kinds of resources or products, and then finally what we refer to as in-depth technical assistance that works with particular states. And then at the across the bottom of the screen, you see how many of those have been fulfilled since the origination of the National Center on Substance Abuse and Child Welfare in the September of 2002. Let's move on then to talk a little bit of background of the program of in-depth technical assistance. We began that in the first of our contracts with the federal government. It is designed to facilitate that cross-system collaboration among the professionals that, again, work across these systems. We certainly recognize that families don't come to child welfare or substance abuse treatment without the need for services from other programs and other service sectors, notably mental health and domestic violence. We certainly recognize that. We encourage jurisdictions that we work with to really understand their own client population and to bring in those other service systems into the collaborative network, if you will, and into their process of working together as they respond to the multiple vulnerabilities that our families come to these systems with. There is an application and an acceptance process. We are just in the fall, we'll be gearing up to begin our fifth cycle of in-depth technical assistance. So we're talking to states and communities right now that are interested in getting started after the first of the year. It is, as I mentioned, about a year and a half, 15 months of a program that is facilitated by a consultant that is provided by the National Center's resources, again, to work with those jurisdictions to set priorities for practice and policy changes and to help them develop their protocols and their implementation plans to respond to these issues. Let me just take a moment and ask if you're a speaker and you don't have your phone on mute, if you can mute your line until it's time for you to be speaking, because we're getting a lot of noise on the phone. Thank you very much for that. As I mentioned, we're just gearing up to begin our round five in-depth TA program, and you see on the slide the prior rounds and the states that we worked with. And then let me show you the next slide, which we're very excited about, the map of the United States that does two things. It gives you the locations of the regional partnerships that were funded by the Children's Bureau last fall. There are 53 sites around the country that have been funded to work on substance abuse and child welfare. You see those with the circles that are color-coded by the focal point, or the way in which we have clustered those grant programs by different types of approaches. So you see those circles all across the country. Practice is changing and jurisdictions are coming together to change their policies to respond to these families that are again at the nexus of these systems. And then the larger stars are those states and locations that you saw just on the prior slide, with the number of states that have worked with the National Center to do some in-depth work on these policy and practice issues. So it's just so exciting to us to look at the map and to see all of the change that is taking place across the country. We're very excited about what is going on and what the face of the country that will look very different in another few years as those grants that are getting started and starting to see clients now as they mature and have lessons to share with all of us about their experience and what they have learned and how we can help other jurisdictions and other states around the country. Finally, then, in talking about the in-depth TA, on the next slide, you'll see the kinds of products that were developed by the states that we've worked with in our program of in-depth technical assistance. We do refer to it with an acronym, IDTA, and you see the kinds of products that they developed to look at their assessment issues, to develop training plans that encourage and provide opportunities for social workers and substance abuse counselors to learn together and to learn about the work of the other systems so that they can better meet the needs of families. Again, I would encourage you to check out our website, and there you see the address at the bottom of this screen, www.ncsacw, that stands for the National Center Substance Abuse Child Welfare, .samhsa.gov, and all of the tools and products that have been developed by the state are on our website. So you have some examples if you're looking for a way to develop principles of working across systems. There's some examples, communication protocols, et cetera. They're there for you to be able to look at and to use, and we appreciate the states that we have worked with in the past making those available to other states and jurisdictions. All right, let's turn then to the good stuff of this webinar and to hear from those that have had some experience with these ways in which the National Center has worked with them, and they have developed over years, really, their collaboratives and their efforts to work across systems and to improve the systems perspectives of for their approach with families. And we've asked our speakers today to respond to several different questions about how they established priorities, how they work together to put the better outcomes for families they serve at the forefront and to work together to ensure that that could happen. How do they sustain this collaborative practice, particularly as politics change, as governors change, as local officials change, as legislators change, and the ever-present ebb and flow of budgets? How do they sustain their collaborative efforts? We've asked them to share with you the most important lessons that they've learned in their use of their time, how they set their priorities about what they take on, how do they work with their stakeholders and the funding issues that they have to deal with, and then to give us their advice. What should jurisdictions that are seeking to develop these kinds of collaborative relationships, what should they avoid in order to be successful? And with that, let's go to our next slide, and let me again just reintroduce Larry Pasty, who will be speaking from New York, and their experience. Larry comes to us from the Bureau of Planning and Intervention Design in the Office of Children and Family Services from New York. So thank you, Larry, for agreeing to spend some time with us today. Let me turn things over to you.
Well, thank you so much, Nancy, and for all of those that are listening, I just want to put a plug in for the great work that the National Center does. We certainly benefited from our work with them and our continuing relationship with them. So if you're interested, jump in. I'm going to start with a little bit on my first slide of talking about the environmental context that we started our journey with the National Center on in New York. And one of the important things is that New York State is, from the child welfare side, a state-supervised county-administered system, so we don't have the same direct control over services at the county level that a state-operated system would have. So we have to work through county government. And in New York State, you've all heard of New York City, and that is a place where things operate differently than the rest of the states, in part because their child welfare children's services is in a separate agency than the rest of the temporary assistance services. We were fortunate that there had been some existing work done between the Administration for Children's Services in New York, which is child welfare, and our state substance abuse agency, where they had developed a protocol just for the city to talk about improving relationships between child welfare and substance abuse providers, that walked through identifying some principles and sharing information and going from initial referral, screening, retention, and release. And so had done a lot of work there, but it hadn't gotten to the level that they wanted. So we had that as kind of a frame to start working from. We also were in the middle of completing some program improvement plan work with our CFSR, and certainly strengthening collaborations around issues like substance abuse was part of that. We've been fortunate in New York State that we have family drug treatment courts in almost all of our counties now on the adult side, and about 13 to 15 counties out of 57 on the juvenile side. So we've had a lot of work in those specialized courts, but really wanted to take this opportunity with IDTA to reach all the rest of the cases in family court. At the same time we applied for this, we were working with our State Division of Budget and our OASIS, which is our state substance abuse agency, to develop a pilot program. We were going to place certified alcoholism counselors for treatment as well as prevention workers from the substance abuse field physically in Child Protective Services to have earlier screening and referral to services. And we were actually going to start at the point of the Child Protective Services call. So we were doing some collaboration on that. And then lastly, again, with the influence of county government, we had been working together both at our agency and with several others around estate agents. We all require separate county plans, and we've been doing some really constructive work to try and get us at the state level to bring those planning processes together, and had piloted some work in a number of counties where they had really done a nice job of getting all the stakeholders together to do county-level planning. So we kind of started a place of certainly some readiness, but realized we had a lot of work to do. In terms of looking at what we accomplished on the next slide, it's work. You know, as much as everyone says collaboration is the way work should be done, and intuitively you tell yourself that's the case, it's always work. Again, as many of the states listening are, we're a large state, so that we had distance and geography issues and ended up doing a lot of our work through conference calls and video conferences. But what we ended up accomplishing by staying at the table was to develop a collaborative guide that starts with the values discussion and carries cases through. And what we decided to do was, using that previous work from New York City as a template, add courts to the mix because they weren't at the table, and that was very important. And then secondly, to use it more as a template that other counties could use and adapt to their unique circumstances rather than issuing as a mandate that everyone has to do. So similar to some of the work that the National Center does in terms of setting out models, we wanted to set it up for the basis of conversation in each county so that they could bring their own level of interest and commitment to it. We were very interested in the cross-systems training plan and have developed what, until we come up with a more exciting name, we're calling 101. So we have Child Welfare 101, which is for courts and substance abuse providers, and a Court 101 for Child Welfare and substance abuse, so around that circle. And then we've used that work to showcase it at a number of conferences. You'll see that the Sharing Success Conference is highlighted because we actually pay for teams of two court personnel and two child welfare personnel to come together for a statewide conference once a year. We've been doing that for 5 years now. Last year was the fifth year. And last year, because substance abuse was a key theme of that, we invited the substance abuse provider world to join that statewide conference. But we've also talked about this work at about six other statewide conferences in the past year, and what's we find very rewarding is the high level of interest, whether it's an audience of child welfare workers from local departments of social services or drug treatment court professionals, that there seems to be a lot of excitement. What are some of the solutions that we employed as we look at the next slide? One of the things we did was, while this was the invitation and the application was a commitment from the three state agencies, even as we developed our application, we knew that we have to work and do work in partnership with our counties and our provider world. So we included representation from the Statewide Association of Child Welfare Professionals, the Statewide Association of Substance Abuse Professionals, and both the Office of Court Administration as well as the Court Improvement Project staff, all in both the application process and all of our ongoing work. So we always had both the state perspective as well as the county or provider perspective, and that was really critical for us. And other states that are state supervised, county administered, we'd encourage that kind of approach. In New York State, many years ago, we actually have separate state agencies. Our agency handles the child welfare issues as a separate state agency, the Office of Temporary and Disability Assistance, that handles the public assistance and temporary assistance funding and programming. They already had certified counselors in local departments of social services for screening on the temporary assistance side, so we included them early on in the process so that we could avoid duplication of effort at the local level, and they've been active and constructive partners as we've gone through this process. I will reinforce what Nancy said earlier about communication. You can't have enough of it, and redundancy is okay. And in encouraging the sometimes difficult conversations of keeping people on board and helping people understand. And I'd like to really highlight that one of the things we found with communication is that links particularly to the cross-systems training needs is the use of words. So in the chemical dependency world or substance abuse world, prevention has a very different meaning than preventive services in the child welfare world. But people think they're hearing the same thing. And so we found after some miscommunication early on, we had to stop ourselves and be very concrete about what some of these words meant or the difference between screening and assessment or evaluation. So part of communication is staying at the table. Part of communication is sharing regularly and often with lots of folks so that people know what's going on. And part of it is making sure that what you say is what's being heard. There was lots of struggles with that, but again, we kept careful notes and so that people could go back and reference some of the decisions that had been made and realize that we didn't always have to redo work. If I then look to some of what we learned from that, and I'll link into the funding slide, is that our systems are very complicated, and it's okay to take small steps and not think that you have to solve all the problems at once. And so that, and that was particularly learned on the funding side. People kind of wanted to say, hey, where's more dollars, and how do we better coordinate at the state level funding processes. When you stop and look at it, we have so many rules from our state comptroller and other regulatory agencies that some of that was difficult, and so we decided that an easy step we could do was just share funding announcements across systems better, and that's proved to be very effective because it really lets other folks in other systems know, for example, if I send out an RFP and I copy the court systems and the provider systems for substance abuse services, then they know what is important to us to fund. And there's also creates opportunities if there is a reluctant member in one of the worlds to pursue funding, other folks in the community may reach out to them and say, this is really a good idea. We'll help you go for the dollars. So we've worked on improving some of that. As we went to do the work on the cross-training, it led us to have conversations about what are the core competencies for workers, and as we've developed those training curriculum, have started the conversations about some of the common competencies or skills that workers might need across all of our systems, that in fact they're dealing with the same families, and therefore when we think about engagement skills, for example, they're very consistent across all of our systems. And so how do we, as state agencies in particular that often provide a lot of the training, both resources and curriculum, better align those kinds of competencies and the training that support them? Data. We all are supportive of using data for more informed decision-making. It influences all of our work. It's a real challenge, yes, maybe in other states, but certainly in our state. Each state agency often ends up developing its own separate databases, often influenced by the regulations of the federal government. And so it's complicated on a hardware side and a technology side often to do that. We've been looking for some creative solutions, and so, for example, with our co-location project, which we're having evaluated, our agency's been working closely with OASIS to be able to track individual outcomes on both the child welfare side and on the substance abuse side through NOMS and some other data that's collected by the state agency using consent forms. So we're making some efforts at trying to work around what are some of the challenges we have now, but as we recognize the need for that, we're more sensitive going forward to with any of our own changes in the databases. When we think about the IDTA, we had some naming challenges that we struggled with in the beginning. One of the parts of it is getting a broader advisory group, and so we included representatives from counties and state agencies from across the state and had an advisory group of about 60 persons that met several times to help us do this work and actively participated. But we had to call them something, and we ended up calling the New York's Partnership for Family Recovery. And so we struggled a little bit with, do we want to create this as a new initiative with its own name, or do we really want to try and get the work embedded into some of the existing work within our systems without name branding it? And so, and then fundamentally, we really just call it IDTA, because that rolls off the tongue a whole lot easier. And so as if we continue to go forward, we've really worked more on how do we take this work and embed it in the ongoing practice in child welfare and courts and the provider world, which is where our training is going, and have spent less energy on trying to keep it as a kind of high-profile new named initiative, though there's certainly high-level support from our commissioners for collaborating. And then a few comments on the having ideas prepared for funding and where we're headed from here. The struggle with funding, and Nancy mentioned the regional partnership grants. We were at the heyday of our product work when this opportunity came up, and we started working on it and found that the time didn't allow us to both work through state government and produce a viable application, so we didn't. But what it really led us to believe is that part of what we need to do as we look at the data and have our conversations is to have identified those gaps so that when opportunities come up, we'll already have formulated an approach or a gap that needs to be addressed, and half the work of a new funding application would be complete. And lastly, where are we going from here? We've had a bit of I'll call it a pause as we finalized our products. Our early 08 teleconference will now be in the fall of 08, but we wanted to make sure that we had our final products cleared through three separate state agencies, and certainly that's a complicated process in some of ours. And we have our training systems that are going to be rolled out in the fall, too. So we really look forward to having all this online and moving fast in the fall. And the last comment on the laminated checklist is what we've been taking from our collaborative guide is really some one-pagers that we can make available to caseworkers at the front line, counselors and substance use agencies or courts, so that they can see some of the highlights of what this work calls for and carry it with them at all times.
Great. Thank you, Larry, very much. Appreciate you taking your time to share your experience with us. I'm going to turn things over to Dan Griffin from Minnesota. And we had a lot of contact with Dan prior to Minnesota applying for in-depth technical assistance. And we thought that worked so well, actually, that we've encouraged other states to be in touch with us and doing conference calls and sharing our materials and facilitating some of those processes that really lay the foundation of the collaborative relationships before states actually get started. So, Dan, we've appreciated that, and let me turn things over to you to share your experience.
Hi. Thank you, Nancy, and thank you, Mary, for having me here, literally here in California. And good morning, good afternoon to everyone who is out there listening. And I will really reiterate what Nancy just said. Having the opportunity to communicate with the National Center ahead of time, create a relationship, and begin laying the groundwork for this effort was really, really helpful for us because there is a lot of work involved. It's extremely important work. But the challenges of collaboration, I think Larry alluded to this, there's a reason why all the work that we do is not as collaborative as it is, and that is because it can be challenging to really build a foundation and get it institutionalized. Once that happens, it's incredible how practice, how people's knowledge, and people's own sense of their place in the system can change. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how we started and the context for us applying for the IDTA. We were very fortunate to have a Chief Justice who was very committed to children's issues. She created the Children's Justice Initiative, which was a statewide initiative mandating all counties to create multidisciplinary teams, basically focused on how they were processing cases and what was the most effective way to do that. Because it was mandated, there were different responses by the local jurisdictions as far as investment and engagement, but with help from state staff, there really has been a phenomenal shift in how the courts and the human services agencies have done business for children and families. The Child Protection Differential Response, our human services office at the state was very instrumental in getting alternative response or differential response going across the state. And so we had two important pieces already in place. One was an excellent structure helping the families before they officially became into the court system and helping them do all they could to stay out of that system. And then once they were in, our teams were really looking at what they needed to do differently as stakeholders. So there was definitely a desire to improve state and local collaboration. The earlier engagement of parents in assessment, treatment, and recovery, that was clear that that was something that needed to happen. We knew from understanding at some core level chemical dependency issues that the sooner people were engaged in treatment and services, the more likely that they were going to have good results, particularly if we were able to maintain them in those services. The improved practice through cross-system collaboration, that was absolutely huge, and that was something that was reflected at the local level, at our regional level, and at our state level. And I'm going to talk a little bit on the next slide about that because I really want to spend some time talking about the collaboration. You'll see that the title says Successful Collaboration Between Courts, Chemical Health, CPS, and Parents. And a lot of that started at the state level. Larry, again, alluded to this, and I really can't reinforce it enough. We had to have some really tough conversations with each other, with the systems. The courts are a fairly powerful group, and we weren't necessarily used to collaborating in the truest sense of the word. Our chemical health division is very focused on providing the services, but did not have much of a relationship with the courts, and there was a lot of concern about our intentions. And so we had to work through that, and one of the ways we did that was through the Shared Values and Principles document, and you can find that on the National Center's website under Minnesota. It's a document that took a lot of time for us to create, a lot of conversation, a lot of process, and there were several points where we said, let's just stop this. We don't want to continue. Because we were getting caught up in the wording, in the different beliefs and perspectives, and so we really had to push through. And it was so good that we had the technical assistance from the National Center, and particularly our faculty person, Carrie Demetris, who is now Carrie Earle. And she was absolutely wonderful for keeping us at the table and helping us talk through those tough things. The enhanced county and tribal engagement, that was very important We had some of the foundation already. We had started talking with counties about this project and getting them involved. And as we started moving through the IDTA, we had more communication with the counties. And for one of the first times in the court's history, we really had a very much more proactive and collaborative relationship with the tribes and inviting the tribes to be a part of this process. The development of the state and local advisory team structures, what we did is we had a state team level, we had an advisory team of our policymakers at the state level, and part of that was just to make sure that we got the buy-in, that there was ongoing education, that they knew the key issues that we were dealing with, the progress that we were making. And really it helped us to build a foundation for where we've come now, which I'll talk more about later. The local advisory teams, we chose to work with only a few counties for the IDTA and really focus our attention on those counties. And each of those had a steering committee. They had steering committees already set up due to the Children's Justice Initiative. And one of the things that we did is we really reinforced two things. One, making sure that you had chemical dependency professionals at the table. It seemed a fairly common thing that people were talking about those issues, but not necessarily inviting those folks to the table. So it was extremely important to have them there and to have an effective collaborative relationship with those. The other key learning for us was the role of the parent partner. We learned early that the voice of the parents, the voice of the consumer, was absolutely critical to a good, solid state project. I mean, it's really easy, I think, sometimes for professionals to sit around and talk with our knowledge about our experience and what we have and what we think are the answers, but to have that check and balance of a parent partner and the voices of the folks who've been through the system has just proven fundamental for us, I think, to really have the right perspective on how we're moving forward. Some of the other things that we accomplished, you can see review and research, apparent focus groups, which I'll talk more about on the next slide, the Catch the Vision toolkit. That toolkit was very important to us because it enabled us to come up with key practices to recommend to all of the folks who would be looking at this issue, not just during the IDTA, but for the future. And so it's something that the National Center has online, we have on our state court's website, and people can go there and they can see those practices, and it gives good step-by-step information about how to implement those practices. And I'll talk a little bit more about some of those key ones as well. I really can't reinforce enough the role of communication and persistence as well in having this be successful collaboration. And it takes a degree of commitment that allows the professionals involved as well to take a look at what are some of the strengths that they're bringing to the relationship and what are some of the challenges. Where do we need to kind of grow in order to have effective collaboration? We had to hear some tough feedback from both of our partners as the courts about some things that we could do differently. And likewise, we were able to give some tough but I think necessary feedback as well to our partners. And we were able to do it in a supportive context. So looking at the next slide is the parent feedback highlights. We had a woman named Denisa Farley. She was absolutely incredible. She had been through the system. She had almost 10 years in recovery, and she became a consultant or a guide for our state committee, and she was a member of the committee, and she was even a member of our core team, which was called the TRI team, one key person from each of the three systems, and then Denisa. And one of the things that we did is we did parent surveys. And we went around the state, we invited parents, and we invited the counties that we were working with to invite parents who had been through the system, currently were in the system, to sit down with us and to give us feedback. I think we did around five of those parent forums, And then we were able to pull together all those responses, and then here, these are some of the highlights of those. I'm not going to go through them all just for the sake of time, but I do want to look at a couple of them. So on the first slide, you look at the middle point. Deliver interventions and services that engage, not alienate the parent to make life improvements. Now, in some ways, we knew that that was true, that that was an important piece, but we didn't realize how important it was and how critical we needed to take a look at those until we heard that feedback from the parents. The delivering interventions and services that engage, really what the parents were saying is, from the moment we come before you, from the moment you come into our home, treat us as human beings, not just a number. Treat us as somebody who you believe in, even though we're doing, you know, difficult things, sometimes horrible things. Give us a sense that you actually have some faith, that we can turn our lives around, and treat us from that perspective throughout. That was powerful to hear, and I can tell you that at the practice level, that is a difficult thing that people, that professionals really have to sometimes take a look at. And we had some very powerful conversations with the professionals, and were able to, I think, get them to see recovery from a different perspective, and that was the educational process as well. On the next slide, all three points are really critical, but I'm just going to go over them briefly. The seemingly endless, confusing, and often conflicting stream of rules, requirements, and paperwork. One of the things that Denisa really brought home for our leadership, all the way up to the Chief Justice who was able to hear this, is that while the three systems need to work together, the three systems also need to streamline their practices to make it user-friendly. The reality is the courts were asking these folks to do a whole lot, child protection's asking them to do a whole lot, treatment's asking them to do a whole lot, and not necessarily talking to one another. We can collaborate all we want, but if we're not thinking of the parent first and foremost and what is going to work for them, within the context, of course, of the best interest of the child, but if we're not thinking of that, it's really difficult for us to set them up for success. And so that feedback they gave us was really important. And one of the things that Denisa often would ask us to think about is, how do you think you would do going through this system, having to do all the things that you just heard me describe? How do you, you know, whether you have a chemical dependency problem or not, how do you think you would do? And so she would often challenge us to put ourselves in the parent's place. So designing the services that reduce the need to separate the family, that is, again, I think somebody that many people working in all the areas would recognize that this is probably a very good practice. The resources available to ensure that this happens creates a challenge. And so we've really been looking at how can we do this in a way that is also cost-effective, particularly in the economic situation that our states are looking at. I know our state is no different than many of the other states, but we're looking at a huge budget deficit, and then there's the targeted case management cuts at the federal level. And so we try to have these conversations in that context, and we're trying to make sure that we emphasize to these folks that we're working with, and the county folks who went through originally, they're the ones who really are able to say, you can implement a lot of these things without additional resources. Don't make this just about having more money in order to make change. Recognizing and including fathers, that was something that I, as one of the few men involved in the core team as well as the advisory team, it was an important piece. And it didn't take long for me to push that for other people to bring it up. And one of the amazing things in the feedback is while we did interview a focus group of fathers, this was one of the most common things cited by both the women and the men and the parents that we spoke with for those surveys, was the need to include the fathers in more effective ways and more respectful ways. There was a lot of comments that said the system often seems that it's set up to not consider fathers as essential participants in the process. So moving on to the next slide, the creative solutions that we employed, again, this just goes back to communication, needing accountable key staff. Myself, Carol Johnson, Jackie Croshew, and Lee Gardner were the folks from the three systems that were part of it. And Jackie was with Human Services, but she also represented the voice of the tribes. And then we had Denisa. The four of us, five of us, we would have weekly conversations. We would meet outside of work. And with Carrie's help, we had difficult conversations because the degree to which we were openly communicating, to the degree to which that we were dealing with conflict and concerns and celebrating our successes was the degree to which the rest of the project was successful. It all kind of emanated from us because we were leading the initiative with the state advisory team, and we were working with the county. And so it was really important for us to have a good relationship. And we actually even got to the point that we had one of the core people, we had a really tough conversation, and one of the core people was actually asked to no longer participate, and we talked to the other division, and they assigned somebody else. And we were able to get through that in a very respectful way, and I think that spoke to the solutions that we had put in place. The honest and effective dedication of resources, I'll talk about very briefly. What that simply is again, that's not funding. That's so much as having our leadership allow us to spend the time necessary. Having the county resources and the county policy folks enable their teams not only to meet, but to say, we want to move forward with some of these things, and here's some staff to do it, here are some services, here's how we're going to reconfigure some of the way our services are already set up in order to make this more likely for success. So those are some of the solutions that we've employed. On the next slide, again, this goes back to what New York was talking about, and Larry, communication is key. And engaging and involving parents, that is really something I cannot emphasize enough. It was extremely important for us to be able to do that and to have the counties do that. And I think if you were to talk to our county representatives, they would say how much they've learned from having those parents who are in recovery and have been through the system at the table and really being a voice. Clarity of roles and responsibilities, that's something that we worked through and really created an effective and somewhat streamlined communication structure. As you've been listening, you've heard me talk about several different entities and multiple committees. And in order to be able to have a system like that work effectively, we really needed to do that well. And that was the communication plan. Moving on to the next slide, a lot of the lessons learned are things that I've already talked about as part of the process that got us to here. The collaborating with consistency and honesty, again, I think I've said a lot about that, but I'll just reinforce it. Identifying best practices and capacities within our own state, that was extremely important. The toolkit that I mentioned that we created, it was one thing for the National Center to offer us best practices. It was one thing for us to look at other national organizations and see what they had to offer. But Minnesota is unique in its own way and has its own resource issues, has its own strengths, has its own services and delivery systems. And so we needed to create that in that context. Embracing the state, county, tribal relationships, that was communication, that was relationship, and that was respecting the ability of the counties to chart their own course. Assuring the partnership with representatives from communities of color, specifically persons from Indian country, that was a challenge for us. It was definitely something we could have done better, but we definitely made a lot of progress, and we continue to make that important and continue to have people of color involved in the process to help us have that voice. And then the recommended strategies that respond to race and culture needs of families and communities, again, that's just something that we do as best we can, especially with the best practices from the human services. Where we are today, things have actually changed for us a little bit, even looking at this slide. So what I can say is, you know, we conducted the first annual survey. We learned a lot from that about the teams. After having the IDTA, we were able to bring 15 counties on board of our 87 counties to be trained at an all-day, two-day state training. Nancy Young came in. We had several other speakers. And this gave them the process to develop their own practices, their own models, working with these resources. We have been encouraging the expansion of family dependency treatment courts. We now just had the National Drug Court Planning Initiative come to Minnesota. We had eight teams go through, and we've got $500,000 that's being ready to be awarded to those counties in order to implement. We had, in the next 3 or 4 months, we're going to have a statewide training on the Children's Program Kit, and that's a tool that I'll give a quick plug to. It was created by the National Association for Children of Alcoholics, and it's available free through SAMHSA. It's an excellent toolkit. It's an excellent resource, and it really enables counties and practitioners to focus on services specifically for children of addicted families and what those children need in order to be successful. And then last, one of the next necessary stages for us has been the process of institutionalization. The Children's Justice Initiative that I spoke about earlier is still a statewide project. It's still a priority for the judicial branch. And now the CJI AOD project, which was what our IDTA was called, Alcohol and Other Drug Project, has been moved into the larger system. And the best I can say at this point is we're cautiously optimistic. We know that this is a necessary stage for us. We are very happy that we're moving forward and we're moving in this direction. And at the same time, it's going to take a whole new level of consistency and commitment for this transition to be effective and for the institutionalization to really be meaningful for the state-level project to embrace basically taking these practices and moving them statewide to all counties. That is essentially where we are. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Dan. We're going to hold questions till the end and move right on to the state of Maine with Bob Long and Michael Brennan. And Michael's been instrumental in the state of Maine for years with bringing together folks around the table to work on these issues. And we appreciate him being here to share his experience as well as Bob, who's had a real leadership role in looking at some of the screening issues that they've institutionalized in Maine. So, gentlemen?
Well, thank you very much for having us here today. And Bob and I are both going to do kind of a tag team approach with the slides. So we'll be moving back and forth between the two of us. And the first thing that I want to say is to echo what the two other speakers have said up to this point is that we received considerable assistance from the National Center for Substance Abuse, and it was very important to us, and we had fairly intensive technical assistance that allowed us to get over a couple humps and work through a couple problems that allowed us to be where we are today. The other thing that I just want to say very quickly, unlike New York and unlike Minnesota, Maine, for all practical purposes, does not have any county system. County government almost doesn't exist in Maine, so that everything we do is really at the state level, and that it goes directly to individual providers and more regional service delivery systems. So the system that we're looking at and what we have to work with is significantly different than a lot of other parts of the country that have fairly well-defined and well-developed county systems. But because we do have several slides, we don't have a whole lot of time. I'll try to move through this as quickly as I possibly can. But simply what happened, the director of the Office of Substance Abuse in 2001 was very concerned about issues related to child welfare and substance abuse. We talked, and she contracted with the Muskie School to do a study looking at issues related to child welfare, substance abuse, and domestic violence and substance abuse. And not surprisingly, we found that across the state there was no uniform screening, assessment, or treatment protocols in cases involving child welfare and substance abuse. And we really operate from the assumption that obviously earlier identification of substance abuse in child welfare issues led to better treatment outcomes, but also facilitated permanency planning. So at the very beginning, what we wanted to do was to develop a more coherent and seamless system of screening, assessment, and treatment. At the same time that report came out, there was a tragedy in the state where a young girl died while she was in the care of the Department of Health and Human Services, and the legislature was doing an investigation into the child welfare system. And in this particular case, the death of the child, the reason that she was removed from the home was due to parental substance abuse. So when we presented our findings to the legislature, they were very sympathetic. There was an issue that they were looking at, and they basically endorsed the recommendations that were made by the report and gave a blessing to the creation of the Child Welfare and Substance Abuse Committee, which was comprised of and chaired by people from the Office of Substance Abuse and from the Department of Human Services, as well as a broad spectrum of providers and other interested parties throughout the state around substance abuse issues. And after 2 years into this, we also brought the court system on board. So that was the context for this at the very beginning, was that we had a study that noted that we didn't have any uniform system in the state, and secondly, we had a tragedy in the state system that the legislature was investigating and gave some significant support at the beginning to this effort. So in the next slide, what we were talking about was at the very beginning developing a screening mechanism, a uniform screening mechanism that was easy to use, easy to understand, easy to train, and easy to implement. And what we, after looking at a variety of different screening tools, we chose to use the UNCOPE, which is a six-question screening tool. And we adapted in a number of different ways that Bob will talk about later. But after we settled on that particular screening tool, we then utilized it in three pilot sites across the state, and it allowed us to refine the tool, and it also allowed us to look at the training mechanisms that we're going to use to bring the staff on board, as well as supervisors and other administrators and other parts of the state. And probably one of the next big things that happened with this project was having the Department of Health and Human Services and their risk assessment process. They adopted the UNCOPE as the screening tool that they would use in every risk assessment that was done in a child welfare case. And that policy was implemented in June 30th of 2006. So what we had for the first time was a statewide screening tool that was used in every risk assessment and was endorsed as official policy by the Department of Health and Human Services. On the next screen, what we ended up finding out that right after we implemented the UNCOPE with the Department of Health and Human Services caseworkers, we realized that the community, what we call alternative response programs, but when there's an allegation of child abuse or neglect, those that aren't high risk are screened out to alternative providers in the community. And those particular providers were not using the UNCOPE, and they had no training on a variety of different issues related to substance abuse. So we went from having a uniform policy within the Department of Human Services to then applying the UNCOPE to all the referrals that were made to the Department of Human Services where there was some suspected abuse or neglect. So we went from roughly doing the screening tool with maybe 1,000 people in the state to almost 5 or 6,000 cases in the state. And again, the intent was to have a broad-based and uniform way that we were identifying substance abuse in all cases that might be involving suspected child abuse and neglect. On the next slide, what we basically were talking about that by July 1st, 2007, all the community intervention program providers in their contract, it was noted that they had to utilize the UNCOPE as a screening tool and that they had to have staff training to facilitate the utilization of the UNCOPE. And I'm going to turn it over to Bob at this point and let him talk a little bit more about the training that we utilized.
Right, and basically the training for the supervisors was a one-day training kind of a thing with a follow-up. And the training included putting this whole thing in context about that you just heard, the historical thing and all those kinds of things. And then we went into talking about substance abuse assessment and the criteria, which there'll be another slide where I'll talk a little about what we did with providers, because we worked, in this case, we're working with caseworkers from the Department of Health and Human Services that are actually working with the families directly and referring to substance abuse providers. And so the training really included telling them how to use this screening tool, the UNCOPE. And the National Center does have a screening and assessment for family engagement, retention, recovery, a safer kind of publication that's available that talks a lot about screening and assessment. But we found the UNCOPE was a well-researched, six good questions. It was more comprehensive and more useful than the CAGE, and it only had two more questions. So we taught the caseworkers how to integrate this into their existing work with families. They're already out there doing family assessments and all of those kinds of things, and how to work these questions in. So you don't necessarily have to sit down and ask these six questions sequentially. There's ways of working this in. And then we talked about using collateral information. So self-reports aren't always accurate, especially early in this whole kind of process. So you can take collateral information and compare them to the questions as well. And so if you want to go to the next slide. Mine comes up a little slower than you guys ever do. So concurrently with the screening initiative, we also worked in the provider community, because one of the things that came out of that whole process that Michael was talking about, that the Muskie's the research that the Muskie School did, is that the receivers of substance abuse assessment information, at least in the state of Maine, were getting reports that were not useful to people that had to make decisions about things. So the committee came up with a set of guidelines about what a good assessment should look like to be used by a variety of different people that have to make decisions about a person's relationship with substances and their ability to care for, nurture, and protect their children. So we developed these guidelines, and we developed a training protocol, and then, as it mentions in the slide, in February of 2006, we did a pilot training program with substance abuse professionals, and these could have been licensed alcohol and drug counselors or master's degree clinicians that were certified in substance abuse treatment. And they came from a variety of different treatment agencies and independent practitioners around the state of Maine. So on the next slide, and then I'm talking about this one, aren't I, Michael?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. Anyway, the data analysis from this pilot program indicated that a more systemic approach would be needed to provide adequate assessments and to get people that were ready, willing, and able to provide these kinds of assessments. So the pilot program taught us a lot about how to choose providers that were interested in doing this specialized kind of assessment and report writing, and actually how to mentor providers in this process to get the quality of product that and the quality of assessment that we were looking for. So I believe the next slide will be you, Michael.
Yeah. Basically, we're just, as I said, we're looking at this as a systemic issue, so that we wanted to make sure that we had, from the very beginning, any parent, family that came in contact with the child welfare system where there was suspected child abuse and neglect, that we had a uniform way to screen that family and screen that situation, make sure that we had protocols established for how, if the parent tested or the screening showed that there was a substance abuse issue, how would they be referred, and then to look and make sure that the agencies that we were referring people to had some type, as Bob mentioned, uniform assessment and evaluation guidelines. And thirdly, we wanted to make sure that people had rapid access to the evaluation and the treatment. And we'll mention here in a little bit further on when we talk about the network, the other thing was making sure that you have a trained cadre of clinicians that actually understand the nuances and differences of doing substance abuse treatment in the context of a child welfare case. And obviously we have a number of different trained professionals across the state that are well-versed in substance abuse but didn't really have some of the understanding of some of the more discrete issues facing child welfare cases. So again, we are looking at this as systemic from the very beginning, having screening, have referral, have assessment, have treatment that really reflected some of the special issues facing parents, children, families within the child welfare system. On the next slide, what we have is the lessons learned. And clearly what helped us from the very beginning was having legislative support and having the endorsement of the legislature allowed us to move forward with this project. The second thing, from the very beginning, we had support from all the key decision makers within the Department of Health and Human Services, within the Office of Substance Abuse, and within the court system. And we also made sure that all the stakeholders on the substance abuse side, as well as parents, as well as providers, were involved in this process. And fortunately, there was enough money that was allocated by the state to support the efforts from the Muskie School to provide research and the staff support for the committee since 2001 up until this day. And one of the first very lessons that we learned was we spent way too much time trying to come up with the perfect screening tool. And we spent almost a year and a half, even close to 2 years, going through different screening tools, testing those, modifying those, and trying to come up with what we thought was the perfect screening tool. And the advice I would give to everybody that's on this conference call at this point is that there is no perfect tool. And it's more important to find a tool that you think is close to what you're looking for, implement it, try it, and move forward with it. And we were fortunate, ultimately, that we thought that the UNCOPE did do what we wanted to do, but we spent way too much time arriving at that decision. And, Bob, I'll turn it over to you to just talk a little bit about the training part.
Okay, that would be the next slide?
Yep.
Okay, why don't we go to the next slide? And so training is crucial, and trying to get people to buy into the process is really important, and how this fits together. So I think we were really successful, and we've just started to see the results of having a statewide screening, where every Department of Health and Human Service office now in the state of Maine is using this tool, and we can start to see geographic differences, and we know, you know, we're starting to see what, at least from the, using this tool, a more clearer picture of the prevalence of substance abuse within this area, and we as part of our guidelines we put two real important things for the screening part was the that you know you could use collateral information in addition to just self report information to see to screen. And supervision makes a difference. So we really worked a lot with the supervisors of the caseworkers about how to incorporate this in overall policy. And we built a system. There's a system in Maine where all new caseworkers go through an orientation and training program that's run through the University of Southern Maine. And we trained those folks that do the orientation in the UNCOPE. And so now there's a sustainability of this thing. It's not built on, you know, I did some of the initial training, but it's not. Now we have it institutionalized that all new caseworkers get exposed to the UNCOPE, and it's in the quality assurance program within the Department of Health and Human Services. So they're keeping track of is it being administered and things of that nature. And then I believe we go to the next slide.
Mm-hmm.
There we go. And then working on the other side of the equation, so to speak, is having this network of qualified professionals is really important. And it's really some of the training now, and the thing we're going to be doing down the road, which we'll get to in a second here, is that not every provider is really ready, willing, and able to do this kind of specialized work, because there's a lot of different – you have – just one piece is that your client is broader than just the person you're assessing, and you're working in the context of a family that's involved in a larger system. And in many cases, if there's if children have been removed from the home, there's a lot of legal stuff. So not every person that goes into behavioral health signed up to testify in court. So there's all kinds of nuances that change who's best doing this. But we were really good at coming up with some best practice kinds of things and really insisting that all assessments have to include collateral information, not just self-reports, and that no matter – rather than have, you know, one assessment tool that everybody uses, no matter what process different agencies were using, they have to all agree to have enough data to really come up with using the American Society of Addiction Medicine PPC2R kind of criteria. And because that'll has six dimensions and it has some consistency, so we worked on that. So I believe the next slide is yours, Mike.
Yeah, and I'm just going to wrap it up fairly quickly again with the next phase that we're moving on to now after having the screening tool, having a common referral and assessment process, is that we're creating a statewide network, and we're doing this without any state appropriation or additional money. We're basically using the power of the state contracting process to create a statewide network of substance abuse providers who are have certified and trained clinicians in the area of child welfare and have agreed to utilize the UNCOPE, agreed to have a uniform assessment process, and agree to be part of this network. So we're very excited about the fact that we think within the next year, by next year at this time, we will have an identified statewide network of substance abuse agencies and individual providers who will specifically work with substance abuse issues related to child welfare. And that was kind of the intent at the beginning, and that's clearly where we're moving at this point. And I guess the one last point that I would make, that one of the biggest issues that we had to overcome was significant distrust between the Department of Health and Human Services caseworkers, child welfare workers, and the substance abuse providers. And there was a fairly significant philosophical difference between the DHHS workers who felt that their primary responsibility was, quote, to protect the child, and substance abuse providers who felt that their primary responsibility was providing substance abuse services. And one of the things that we've had to work through over the last 7 or 8 years is that philosophical difference, where we're really coming up with collaborative treatment planning and really looking at family-focused treatment as opposed to treatment that ends up choosing sides. So I'll conclude there, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you, Bob. This is very exciting what's going on in Maine, and we appreciate so much the work that you've taken on to make all of this happen. Operator, I think we may have time for one question, if we can open it up and see if anybody has a question.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key.
Great. And while we're waiting for any questions that may come in, let me thank our presenters once again, and also for all of you in the audience that have participated in the webinar today. You've heard it a few times. Please do visit our website, ncsacw.samhsa, that's SAMHSA.gov. Many of the things that you've heard about today are on the website, and if you have any questions that come up after the webinar, please do email us, info@ncsacw.com. You'll see our website on the screen now that shows you how to get there and the website, and you can click on the Contact Us and send us an email if you have any questions that you'd like us to follow up with or questions for our presenters that we didn't get to today.
And this is Mary O'Brien from Organizational Improvement. Just to say that there's also will be a playback feature available on our website, www.nrcoi.org. If there are people you think might like to hear this presentation, it will be, at least the audio file will be on our website as well.
Great. Thank you very much, Mary. Operator, did you get any questions in?
I'm showing no questions at this time.
All right. Terrific. I think we're ending just about right on time. So, again, thank you very much for your participation today. Thank you, Mary, and the NRC on Organizational Improvement for making this possible, and to the other staff at the National Center who pulled all this together. Thank you all very much, and have a nice afternoon.
Thank you very much. And if you get a chance, please fill in the evaluation for today's call, which you'll get an email about that from Help Kids, and it's an online evaluation form. We'd love any feedback that you could give us. Thanks very much for coming, everyone.
Ladies and gentlemen, this does conclude your conference. You may all disconnect. Everyone have a wonderful day.